Hi everybody, I'm Sean from Follow the Camino, and in this episode of Camino Talks, I'm joined by Portia Jones and Rupert Parker, two freelance travel writers. I want to see what their job is really like, how things have changed for them as a result of COVID-19, and what the future looks like for travel writing in general. Thank you, Portia and Rupert, for joining the show.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you.
So firstly, Portia, perhaps you could kind of introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about what you do.
Sure. I'm a freelance travel writer and podcaster. I have my own travel website as well. I have a regular travel podcast called Travel Goals. I write for a few different outlets. I also do some audio stuff for BBC Radio. So I'm a regular contributor on a range of sort of travel topics, destination inspiration, that kind of thing. And I also own a music production library with my husband. And we provide music tracks for various media productions, including radio and TV.
Great. So there's a lot of different pieces there. And just for people, you actually did a trip on our behalf last year for our One Foot Abroad brand, which was to Cape Verde.
So, I did. It was fantastic. Such a wonderful experience. I really enjoyed that trip.
Great. Thank you. And Rupert, who is Rupert Parker?
Hi, Sean. Most of my life, I've been a TV documentary maker. So I've been making films and I traveled the world doing that. And recently, or in the last 20 years, in between jobs, it's a bit like acting. You know, it's feast or famine. So I started doing travel writing and traveling, and that sort of replaced my day job, as it were. So now my day job is traveling the world at somebody else's expense, writing for various magazines, newspapers, both online, and even doing some TV.
Great, thank you. And I think you were also due to do a trip on our behalf for our Follow the Camino brands, doing a pilgrimage on the Via Francigena leading into Rome. I think it was in May of this year, but that obviously has been put on hold, unfortunately.
Yes, it's a shame. I was really looking forward to it. It was a good long 10 or 12 day hike, but hiking through some of the nicest parts of Italy with some great food and wine, of course. The great joy of hiking is that you can, in theory, you can eat as much as you want and drink as much as you want without putting on weight. But of course, that's never the case. So it's a big shame that's cancelled. But I hope to do that once lockdown and quarantine is over.
I hope so too. Okay, maybe I'm going to start with Portia. Just talk about travel writing in general. Like, it sounds like it's the perfect job. People pay you to go on holidays and take pictures.
It is travel has been my whole life since I was 18. I worked abroad, studied abroad. I've backpacked around the world. I've been very fortunate in that respect. Like, travel has been such a huge part of my life, and travel writing's an extension of that. And it is a great job. I mean, I get to experience a range of destinations, meet fantastic people, you know, and try all these incredible experiences, which perhaps I wouldn't be able to try, as a sort of regular tourist, I suppose. I think one of the big perks about the job, perhaps Rupert will agree, is sometimes you do get to have these sort of additional experiences or kind of like insider tips or go to locations that perhaps you might not be able to go to easily otherwise. But it is hard work. I mean, obviously, you know, if you can make it look easy, you've done a good job. But it's incredibly long hours. It can take a toll on, you know, your home life as well. So last year, I think I was away for 50% of the time. So constantly on the road, living out of a suitcase, deadlines, you know, and it can take a toll on your sort of health as well, because you're constantly eating. Yeah. I know we could reference that with the Italy trip. And yeah, I actually did an Italy trip last December around the Lombardia region. And my God, I mean, don't get me wrong, this is definitely one of those first world problems, but I I pretty much worked out that we're spending about 5.5 hours a day just eating.
Yes.
You know, they'd be like, here is your 4-course lunch, and now we're having our 7-course dinner. And it was great because I love Italian food, but oh my God, I came home and I was thinking, I'm just going to have to live off dust the next month. So it can be pretty grueling. And like I said, pretty long hours. Some of the press trips I've done have been sort of 16-hour days in some cases. Or they can be physically strenuous. When I did the press trip for you guys going over to Cape Verde, those were long hiking expeditions. So some of the trails we were doing were 18 kilometers. So yeah, if you're doing a particularly physical trip as well, that can be quite hard. I wouldn't change it for the world though. I love my job, but I think people need to be aware that, you know, it's not as easy as it looks. And, you know, especially in times like these, it can be challenging in terms of, you know, getting gigs and payment and all that kind of stuff, as obviously coronavirus is highlighting for us right now.
Great. And so Rupert, maybe on the same kind of question, is it as easy as you decide, I'd love to go to Bulgaria or Sweden next month, you just ring up a newspaper and they send you away? Is it that easy?
Well, it would be good if it did work like that. I always have a sort of hit list of places I want to go to, which nobody wants to send me to. I'm a bit like Portia. I'm away. Last year, I think I did 40 trips, which meant I was away almost every week of the year. But a lot of times you get invited to places you've been to before. And sometimes it's quite difficult to get to those places that you really want to write about and really want to visit. So it's not easy. And also, part of that process, and I don't want to over-egg this, but it's to get one trip is not a single phone call. It's about 40 or 50, even 100 emails. I'll sometimes look at my email trail and I think, well, it took me a year to get to this. The longest one was Bangladesh, which ultimately was a fantastic experience, but it took about 3 years, and the trip was on, then it was off, then it was on again. So it's a lot of work. I mean, as Portia says, it's a lot of work on the road, long, long, long days. Often you change hotels every night, pack, unpack. You can't be sick. You can't have a rest day. But ultimately, you know, I wouldn't do it if I didn't want to do it. It's a fantastically rewarding experience. And when you get to the places you want to go to, it's ultimately very, very rewarding.
So it is it is a job. Do you make a living from it? Is it, or can there are lots of travel writers. Do they all make a full living from it?
Well, I have a lot of colleagues, of course. I know of very few who actually make a full-time living out of it. Most of them have to do other things like newspapers, copywriting, working in the pub. I mean, it's very badly paid. You can't. It's quite difficult to support yourself, you know. But on the plus side, if you're away, your food and lodging is paid for. But in terms of making a fortune and retiring with a nest egg, no way.
Yeah, I agree with Rupert. It can be really difficult, and I've always been someone that's had multiple jobs or interests, that kind of thing. Anyway, so I do make money from travel writing via commissions, but as I said earlier, I've also got my own travel website, Pip in the City, which makes money itself. I do other things as well. Like I said, I've got a business with my husband. I also do some freelance podcast stuff, radio stuff. So, I mean, it's only really a part of my income. I think if it was my whole income, that's a lot of pressure, I think, isn't it, Rupert, to suddenly have, you know, all your entire income on something like that. But you know, lots of people do make it work, and it definitely, I know travel writers who do make a full-time living from it, but it's it's as Rupert said, it's not easy, and a lot of people do have
yes.
you know, other side hustles, other gigs. Like I said myself, certainly it only forms part of my income.
And do you specialize in a certain type of travel writing, like for a certain audience? Because you could obviously go somewhere and be a generalist and talk about the beaches and stuff, or do you have a specific angle that you you are known for?
I do, of course, general travel. I do quite a bit on music. I do quite a lot of food because I'm interested in food and wine, of course. But what I sort of specialise in is sort of outdoor activity type travel, particularly hiking, cycling, canoeing, anything which is quite challenging, because a lot of travel writers, a lot of journalists are not the ideal people to do these trips, because, you know, the image of the tired old hack who can't manage it. I have to say, I've been away on trips with some of my colleagues, and they haven't, you know, I was once in Luxembourg walking in up, and there are only small hills in Luxembourg, it's not difficult. And there was a couple from Belgium. And on the first day, we were wandering up this very gentle climb. And he said, nobody told me it was going to be like this. And I said, but the trip, it said, the title of the trip is Hiking Without Baggage. So hiking is there. He said, yes, remember, he's from Brussels. He said, yes, but nobody said it was going to be uphill. So my niche, I like to think, is doing the more strenuous types of activities, which my fellow journalists wouldn't normally do.
Okay. Thank you. And Portia?
Sort of the same as Rupert, really, funnily enough. I'm quite a generalist. I tend, you know, I do city breaks, sort of like slightly older travel. Like, I don't do any sort of like backpacker, you know, stay in a $8 a night hostel. Believe me, I've been there and I've done that, and I that time has passed me. But I actually do a lot of adventure travel as well. So a lot of, you know, hiking, biking, all those more sort of adventurous, strenuous kind of trips as well, which is great. I used to actually work in outdoor education in Australia, so yeah, I love sort of being outside and doing those more physical trips. But as I said earlier, they can be quite tiring, even if you are reasonably fit. You know, if you're doing 16-hour days, and that includes, you know, hiking up mountains or cycling or anything like that, yeah, it can be quite exhausting. And very often, you know, you'll get back to your hotel and there'll be all dinners and drinks and socializing, which, again, I don't want to sound ungrateful, that's fantastic, but very often you're absolutely shattered. And obviously whoever's hosting you really wants to give you a nice time, and, you know, oh, come to the bar, and you're like, oh God, I need to lie down.
Yes, indeed. So how has 2020 and COVID-19 impacted you and your business?
Well, of course, but I haven't been anywhere. I've been cooped up at home, catching up on processing photographs, writing articles of places, about places I've been to already. But in real terms, you know, I've been traveling around my living room, and actually, in terms of income, although I've managed to generate some, not a huge amount. But then, of course, you know, I can live at home quite frugally. But the real and of course, when it's all this and the lockdown lifts, then maybe things will get better. But the real thing is, it's a bit like eating the same in the same restaurant for every meal, for a chef who's reasonably good but tends to overstretch. I'm talking about myself. So it's the variety I've been missing. I don't mind being on my own. You know, as a travel writer, oftentimes you spend quite a lot of time on your own, so you have to be self-sufficient. So the being confined indoors hasn't been too terrible, but actually, ultimately, I want to get out and tell people about new things to do.
Okay, thank you. Portia?
Well, obviously, all press trips are cancelled, so like my writing gigs in that respect were gone, but actually managed to pivot to doing some audio content. So I got a contract with a tourism board in the UK to produce some podcast content for them once restrictions lift. I'm in talks with another one because I've got my own podcast and we've got a recording studio in our house. Luckily, I've been able to pivot to audio content as well, but doing it for travel brands and for tourism boards. So luckily, I've had something to keep me occupied because, yeah, whilst, you know, as Rupert said, you do spend a lot of time by yourself as a travel writer. So I'm kind of okay with, you know, being by myself and all that kind of thing, but I need things to do. I'm quite an antsy person. And everyone's like, oh, you can have a lovely bit of time off because you do a lot of travel. I'm like, I don't want time off. I want to be busy. I want to be doing stuff. So I've been quite fortunate in that I was able to pivot to more audio sort of content creation in that respect. But I mean, it's just a very uncertain landscape right now. I'm in touch with, you know, some editors I write for, tourism boards that I work with, and no one really knows what's going to happen at the moment. We don't know if and when there'll be a second wave, or, you know, what travel's really going to look like once borders start properly opening and accepting tourists in. I mean, I know there's been talk of destinations trying to entice people back. I'm not sure if you saw, Rupert, places like Sicily in Japan saying they'll fund, you know, some of your flights and hotels, but whether that will translate to, you know, tourism boards looking for additional coverage, I don't know yet. No, the people I've spoken to for sure seem a bit uncertain.
Yes, definitely. And in terms of what you think that the future holds for travel writing in general, like, I know obviously travel companies are impacted at the moment. People are not booking, there's restrictions everywhere, quarantines, newspapers have reduced or eliminated travel supplements. This could go on for a while. Like, do you see travel writing as a career changing? Like, what will it look like in next year, for example? People will travel less, maybe travel to different places, there's less money available. What's that hold for you?
I think I'm optimistic. I think people, even more so, will, once lockdown is lifted, once restrictions are lifted, they'll want to go away. They'll want to get out, whether they go, and I think they'll start going to places nearby, maybe in the UK or, and then in Europe. But I think people, you know, it's, they're going stir crazy. They want to get out. And I think the sort of travel will be different, though. I think they'll be more interested in, not in city break so much, but actually the sort of things that I quite like, which is, you know, where you can, where you're not so much with people, going hiking in the mountains, cycling through the, along the river, all these sort of things. So I think people will, I think mass tourism, the days of the buffet in the hotel and the bucket and spade thing, I think those will change. And I've also seen that throughout this lockdown, a lot of tourist boards have been having webinars. They're keen to keep reminding people of rewriters destinations. So I hope, but I don't know, although I do have a few invitations already, that when the lockdown eases, then I'll be out writing about their destinations. So, yeah, there'll probably be less money. But I think, you know, a lot of countries depend on tourism as a major source of income, and they're not going to stop trying to promote that. And if the pot is smaller, then they're going to be fighting for their share of the pot. So, you know, if nobody invites me, if I don't travel anymore, well, so be it. But I'm confident that won't happen.
Yeah, and it's interesting you say about maybe mass tourism and people will change how they holiday. Like, from our own perspective on the Camino business, which is the pilgrimages routes in Spain, we're seeing like a lot more people inquiring about walking full routes, like 5, 6, 7 weeks of a holiday, as opposed to just 1 or 2 weeks. So I think people are looking for maybe something slightly different and a bit more meaningful, and they're willing to take longer to do it. So I think that's a kind of a promising trend as well. Like people will be more mindful of the holiday that they take and maybe want to make the most out of it with their time and money.
I think you're right.
Sorry.
Oh, it's okay. No, I was just about to say, I think you're right with that. I think the nature of how people travel will change. And I think the travel industry potentially could change. I think the age of mass tourism, where you can fly to Barcelona for like, you know, £12 and just go for 48 hours, perhaps that will change. And in many ways, perhaps it needs to change as well, because, you know, there were outrageously cheap travel deals, which is great if there's like smaller, less crowded destinations. But for destinations that were already suffering from mass tourism, like Amsterdam and Venice, I mean, that's the tourists now are having a huge impact on the quality of life of the residents as well. And I think that's been a long brewing problem and discussion and even argument in some case that absolutely needed to be addressed. And Corona has forced this issue now because, you know, there are no tourists in Dubrovnik, Amsterdam, Venice. And I think the locals are pretty happy about that. So I think you're right in that people are perhaps think more about slow travel or eco travel or, you know, destinations with a bit more space, because we're all obsessed with hygiene and distancing now. So maybe walking holidays or staycations or more remote locations will see a surge.
Okay.
Well, just to add to that, I was just yesterday writing about my hiking along doing the Camino Primitivo that goes from Oviedo to Santiago. And I was comparing it with doing the French way. And the French way, which is the normal Camino way that everybody does, is very, very, very crowded, I have to say. Whereas other Caminos, I think, will benefit from you know, post-lockdown, because I think they present, A, you can do your social distancing, and B, you know, they're fantastic to really getting away from it.
Okay, that's interesting, Rupert. In terms of the future of travel writing, obviously you both make some sort of a living from it, and it's writing for magazines, newspapers. Portia, you mentioned pivoting towards doing audio podcasts for tourism boards. What do you see as how will content be portrayed in future? Is it video rather than print, or does print still have a kind of a place? Is it audio, podcasts, downloads? What does it look like?
I think they're just going to have to really think about you know, how they market a destination. Now, I think there'll always be a place for print, especially for a certain type of destination who's looking for a certain type of tourist, you know, with a spending power especially. But yeah, I think tourism boards, certainly from the conversations I've had, hence the pivot to audio, are sort of now starting to think, well, how can we bounce back from this? How can we present our destination in innovative and interesting ways now? And given that there's been an explosion over the last 5 years or so in podcasting and the amount of podcasts available, a lot of tourism boards are sort of thinking, oh, maybe that's an avenue we could explore, because it's evergreen content. So if you create a whole series for a destination, I mean, as long as you're not going into too many, you know, go to this cafe, for example, you know, that's kind of evergreen content that could last for years. Once you've put it on something like iTunes, you know, you can kind of leave it then. You obviously do your occasional promotion, but it's there and it's available for people to download as well. So I think they're just looking at different ways to kind of manage and promote their destination. Video's always been quite big, especially on social media. So perhaps they'll have a bit more of a pivot to video, especially if they're trying to convince people that destinations are safe and hygienic, the social distancing. Maybe a good way to display that is through a video campaign.
Okay.
Yeah, just to add to that, I, for my sins, have been a judge on juries. There are a number of festivals which deal with short tourist films made by tourist boards, surprisingly enough. And there are four or five or six every year. And I've been on the jury. And I have to say, in general, the quality of the videos that tourist boards produce are pretty awful. But also they try to be all things to all men. So they'll say, well, come to Slovenia. We've got beaches, we've got mountains, we've got lakes, we've got this. They try, but actually what they should do is concentrate on what they do best and what's unique about them. And again, I think if we're looking at sort of the future, people want to go somewhere that has something unique. And that's why that's the selling point.
Okay, great. So I really appreciate you both taking your time on this kind of interview. Perhaps one last question for each of you, and I'll start with Rupert. What is your most memorable trip that you've ever done, and why?
Well, I was thinking about this, and I've done 40 trips every year. There are a lot of trips to choose from. But I think my favourite, and now I look back, was probably the most adventurous. 30 or 40 years ago, I wanted to go to Tibet. I'd never been to Tibet, but growing up as a kid, the those pictures of Potala Palace in Lhasa had always fascinated me. So one day I'd take leave. I was working in television at the time. I thought, I'd like to go there. So I looked into it. And remember, this is 40 years ago, and China was just about opening up then. So it was becoming possible. So I went to the Chinese embassy, got a visa, and I said, will this get me into Tibet? And they said, we don't know. And I said, well, how do I find out? And they said, we just have to go there. So I flew to Kathmandu, and I went to the Chinese embassy there and said, does my visa get me into Tibet? They said, we don't know. I was in backpacking, so I talked to backpackers. Will this get me to Tibet? We don't know. So eventually I took a taxi to the border and told the guy to wait for me and see when I got to the border post whether I got through. So I walked down, and the border post, one of those classic things, it's a bridge across a river in some deep gorge, and I crossed the river. And I get to the checkpoint, I put my passport there, and the guy looks at it, stamps it, and lets me in. I'm like, yes, I'm in. So the taxi drives off. I go to this tiny place where I'm in a truck driver's hostel where they play cards all night. And next day I get on the back of a lorry with 40 other people. I mean, Tibetans, Chinese, and there are a couple of other backpackers. And we go up to 20,000 feet over the high passes, amazing views of Mount Everest. And it got colder and colder and colder. And finally it got dark. And the guy wasn't going to stop. And we said, we stop, 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 stop. So eventually we stopped and actually got some sort of basic hotel. And next morning, we descended and descended and descended and got to Tibet's second city, Shigatse, suffering from altitude, suffering from cold and just completely worn out. And I think now it was one of my most exciting trips because I didn't know what to expect. And actually the achievement of setting out and eventually getting to Lhasa and eventually having yak burgers in the Potala Palace, fantastic.
That sounds amazing. It's probably something that you couldn't repeat in this day and age. Now, in most countries, you wouldn't get past the border guards, or you wouldn't get past the customs post without the right kind of visa.
Well, the other interesting thing is, which has changed, of course, is then there was no internet. Now you would just Google and you would find somebody who would know. You'd find that information. Then nobody knew. And so that's what made it, you know, in a sense, you know, travel, even the trips I do as a travel writer, you know, the biggest rewards are things that happen that are unexpected. And it's the unexpected which makes it exciting. So that's just an example.
Thank you. And Portia, your most memorable trip?
Oh, gosh. So a little bit like Rupert, I like the element of surprise and not really know what's going on. And I love, don't get me wrong, I love work trips, I love press trips, I love the trips I do now, but the trips I did years ago, the proper backpacker type trips, pre-internet, pre-smartphones, are probably some of my favorite because it felt like, you know, anything could happen. And one of my most favorite was I went backpacking around Southeast Asia with a flamboyant Irish girl that I'd met working in Camp America. And it's, and we just, I can only describe it as we lurched from one disaster to the next. You know, in the most wonderful way, we were staying in like $2 a night hostels in Cambodia. You know, we'd get on the wrong buses. I ended up with cholera in Vietnam. That was an interesting experience. We got robbed, the bank machines swallowed our cards, and there was no one to check, am I doing the right thing? Am I going to the right place? You know, should I eat this? Because there was, I mean, it's not that the internet didn't exist. This was about 10 years ago, but I didn't have a smartphone. So I didn't have a phone that worked with me. I had like a terrible old hand-me-down, what I like to call rip-off BlackBerry that didn't work. So we just had to kind of backpack around and get all of our travel info either from like this completely tattered, lonely planet that I think was kind of out of date and other travelers. And I loved that because there was a real sense of adventure and you had no idea what was going to happen next. And now, because of the internet, smartphones, WhatsApp, TripAdvisor, you know, Skyscanner, everything is a lot more planned and sanitized and safe. Which, you know, in some ways that's quite good. It's not that safety is necessarily a bad thing, but I miss the sort of the invention of travel in those kind of days where, like I said, it's you never quite knew what was going to happen.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think some of my favorite trips as well are the same things where you basically just, you're going almost into the unknown. Nobody knows where you are, and you don't care that they don't know where you are, and it's just what might happen is for me the best part of travel. Okay,
yeah, well, just to add to that, I mean, another trip that I did, I set off from, I was filming in Rio, and I thought, well, I'm in South America, I'd like to see South America. So I left, I said goodbye to the crew at Rio bus station, and I got on the bus. To travel, my plan was to travel all the way across to Peru, up and back down and around. And I got on the bus. I was terrified that, you know, my things would be stolen. I had said, you know, all these stories about South America being dangerous, you know, tarantulas, all this sort of thing. And the bag on the bus, so it traveled through the night, and eventually it stopped, and I was starving. And I went up to the I went into the restaurant, and it was a place where you had to pay for the food before they would give it you. But I spoke no Spanish and no Portuguese, and I couldn't get any food. It was terrible. And I thought, how am I going to survive? And of course, you know, what you learn is you point at the food and they give it you. It's not difficult. But, you know, that sense of doing something where you really are out of your comfort zone, but you survive, I think is the most extraordinary experience.
It is. Well, I really appreciate both of you taking your time to kind of talk to me today. And I really hope that in the coming months, you both will be out on the road and writing about some lovely destination. And I wish you the best of luck, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Thanks.
Thank you both. Bye-bye.